This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. And now stay tuned for Press Watch.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for the news you're not supposed to know. This, for example, well, this is the news you're supposed to know. It's a quote from Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, the Armed Services Committee's top Democrat and soon-to-be chairman, quote, "The American people have said forcefully that they are impatient with Iraqi leaders who will not make the political compromises required to blunt the sectarian violence and unite the Iraqi people." What an idiot. Hey, Carl Levin, the American people said no such thing. I'm pretty sure we said something like, in the war, and stop lying, and get rid of those bogus vote counting machines. It isn't a war anyway on our part, it's a bloody occupation. It isn't an insurgency on the Iraqis' part, it's a civil war, and it's a war against occupation. They aren't casualties when we bomb them, they're murder victims. It isn't Iraqi leaders who tore apart the country and started the death squads. It was the U.S. through the offices of John Death Squad Negroponte. You know, the terror of Tegucigalpa? Yeah, he's there. It's not about political compromise. It's about withdrawal. It's not about Iraqis or Afghanis, for that matter. It's about the United States. We lied. We bombed. We invaded. We are the problem. For that matter, it isn't interrogation, it's torture. It isn't a preemptive strike, it's imperialism. We're not at war with terrorism, we're being terrorized by our own government. The nukes threatening the Middle East aren't in Iran, they're made in Israel. When will Israel accept nuclear inspectors? When is the preemptive strike against the nuke factory at Dimona? Who flattened Beirut, by the way? Number to call with your comments, 503-231-8187. Chris Floyd writes in Empire Burlesque, "Bush knows that he cannot do what he would have to do to, quote, win, end quote, the war on his terms. Send in hundreds of thousands of more troops in a brutal, no-holds-barred campaign to eradicate all active opposition to the imposition of a docile Iraqi regime and the permanent installation of American bases. He knows there is no political will, even amongst his own party and most of his base, to take this route, barring, of course, another convenient terrorist attack on American soil, this time blamed on Iraqi insurgents. Then there would be no limit to Bush's justifiable retaliation. This scenario, though unlikely at present, is certainly not to be discounted altogether." And Chris Floyd also writes, "And so he is going to intensify the war as much as politically possible, push the envelope of further brutality and repression as far as he can, for as long as he can, and hope that this will finally do the trick. It won't, of course, but as The Guardian notes, quoting a former top Bush official, he is in a state of denial about Iraq. Nobody else is anymore, but he is. He believes that his willfully ignorant gut feelings, formed, of course, out of the malevolent whisperings of his handlers, especially those who most assiduously flatter his prejudices and his enormous infantile ego, must be correct and will win through in the end." Number to call, 503-231-8187. This is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Returning to Chris Floyd's article, "Thus Bush is now planning to send at least 20,000 more troops to Iraq to secure Baghdad and free up the U.S. forces currently tied down there to spread out and pacify the rest of the country. There will be a stab at securing regional cooperation for the successful rehabilitation of Iraq. The Saudi and Kuwaiti royal families, longtime business partners of the Bush family, will be hit up for reconstruction money, more fodder for Bush-connected contractors, and the bottomless corruption of the Bush-backed Iraqi government. How then will this be different from the epic of waste and corruption we have already seen in the reconstruction process?" And to depart from Chris Floyd's script, how about that $9 billion? Where is that $9 billion? Who knew about the $9 billion and when? That would be an interesting thing to ask, but with the attitude of Carl Levin, are we going to be able to get there? I mean, this is basically a racist attitude. to smash a country. Since 1991, we've been smashing Iraq, starving Iraq, overflying Iraq. And that means the people there have been driven down into desperation and horror. And then we pretend that they've got a problem. Impatient with Iraqi leaders. Let me quote Carl Levin again. The American people have said forcefully that they are impatient with Iraqi leaders who will not make the political compromises required to blunt the sectarian violence and unite the Iraqi people. What a load. Who messed the place up? And what's he saying? Is he saying that there's some superior race somewhere that would actually, you know, just totally have it together after being murdered and murdered and murdered and murdered? I don't think there is any. Well, other things are cooking. Perhaps you've heard here or there or on KBOO News or in the margins that Rumsfeld's got some legal trouble. And Rumsfeld does, and it's very encouraging. Carol Rosenberg writing in the Seattle Times for McClatchy Newspapers, just to be specific, writes, civil liberties lawyers turned to a German prosecutor Tuesday in their latest quest to open a war crimes investigation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other architects of detention policy at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and in Iraq. Hoping Rumsfeld's resignation will help their case, the lawyers went overseas with a 380-page complaint application that alleges Rumsfeld oversaw policies that condone torture. The Pentagon said the complaint was without merit, claiming it has investigated and dealt with detainee abuse allegations appropriately. The complaint, championed by New York Center for Constitutional Rights, also names other still active members of the Bush administration, notably Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence Stephen Cambone. It includes an affidavit from former Army Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, who claims she was blamed unfairly for letting military police run amok at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And here's a quote from her. She says, I am willing to testify in a German criminal investigation because of the prisoner abuses in Abu Ghraib and the release of intentionally misleading information when it was clear the knowledge and responsibility goes all the way to the top of the chain of the command, to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and to the Vice President, Dick Cheney. That's Karpinski in a document she released Tuesday. So how about that? Your comments, 503-231-8187. Now, of course, I'm greatly cheered to see that someone somewhere has said the words war criminal and pointed to the war criminals. I heard a wonderful, and perhaps you also heard, a wonderful debate yesterday on Democracy Now!, which we will be broadcasting at 11 p.m., 11 a.m. Today as well. Not the same broadcast, but another broadcast. And yesterday there was a wonderful debate with Senator McGovern, with Dennis Kucinich, and with a right-winger. And I got in the middle of it and missed the identity of the right-winger, who I think is with a Washington think tank. And it was really interesting to hear him, to hear the right-winger bluster and repeat the same lies about Iraq. And just attempt to, he attempted to bully his way through the conversation. He didn't have any new information. Actually, the information that he had was bogus, so he didn't have information at all. All he had was bluster, and it was great to hear him back down. Democracy Now! On KBOO 90.7, KBOO Portland, and that's what you're listening to right now. German legislators in 2002 gave prosecutors the power to investigate international human rights crimes regardless where they were carried out. The underlying principle is that countries are unlikely to be self-policing on such crimes. U.S. sovereignty, along with the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, effectively protects senior government figures while still in office. Guess what happened to Rumsfeld? What happens when they return to private life is another matter. The Pentagon long has defended its detention and interrogation policies as humane, war on terror necessities, and said scattered cases of abuse were investigated and dealt with internally. The Center for Constitutional Rights failed in a 2004 bid to launch a German investigation, as prosecutors cited that the U.S. was looking into abuse allegations on its own, but the center's president, Michael Ratner, cited several changes since then. Number one, Rumsfeld resignations means he will be a private citizen soon, stripping him of any customary European immunity as a defense minister. Secondly, a New York lawyer has met with and received permission to speak for a Saudi captive at Guantanamo, Mohammed al-Qahtani, who, according to leaked reports, was subjected to controversial intensive interrogation techniques, we call that torture, at Guantanamo, among them long bouts of sleep deprivation, isolation, and sexual humiliation. Thirdly, Congress' new Military Commissions Act attempts to grant immunity to the U.S. military and civilian leaders for past interrogations, throwing the ball into Europe's court. And Ed has called. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Yeah, this sounds pretty promising as far as using judicial review. I've been reading this Anatomy of the Nuremberg Tribunals by Telford Taylor for the last couple of months. And, you know, first of all, Hitler had a guy, Alfred Jodl, I think. He specialized in turning wars of aggression into preemptive wars with propaganda.
Jodbels?
What's that?
Goebbels, the propaganda minister you're talking about?
Well, he was some type of... He was within the... Like, within the cabinet, you know what I mean?
Yes,
but
yes,
his, like the Secretary of Defense or something.
Yes, and
but
they
his
were
job
for
was
that.
Like Hitler's wars of aggression. He would say, nah, like, he'd come out with big... These are really preemptive wars and stuff, you know?
There's always an excuse.
Just and, like Bush has, you know?
Exactly. Yeah,
and it's so... And then they said, well, you get the structure. They had teams, you know. They set up the teams between the English and the French, the Russians and the United States. So there may be, like, a team set up in the Middle East between, like, all the countries affected, like Iran and Syria, Iraq.
I should elaborate for those who are perhaps younger that the Nuremberg trials were held after World War II to try the Nazis for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and for their genocide of the Jews, the homosexuals, the gypsies, and the communists, and anyone else they didn't like.
Yeah, like just like Bush picking on the immigrants in the last couple of days. That's like right out of Nazi Germany.
And one of the things that was gotten out of the Nuremberg trials, besides the fact that some crimes simply cannot be excused, is that saying that you are merely taking orders is not enough. And it doesn't seem to be a lesson that was well learned in the U.S.
They talked about criminals hiding out in soldiers' uniforms, hiding behind the honor of a soldier to commit crimes.
Well, that's a good phrase, hiding behind the honor of a soldier to commit crimes.
Yeah, and, you know, they have the structure of their government, they bring that in, and then they have, like, all the ministers, and they have all the orders that they signed, and like, from Hitler, and then they go to their subordinates, and they brought them in, and then they went into the areas where the crimes were, and then they went for, like, witnesses and stuff. So that would, like, you know, they would go into, like, Abu Ghraib or Sadr City, they would gather up all this evidence and stuff, and then they would come back and use it against Bush and his high command, you know? That's to show our face to the world. I think that would be the minimum, you know, because it's outside of impeachment. We've ratified all these treaties under law. We really have to enforce them, or the rest of the world will enforce them.
Right on, and it brings up what I've been thinking over the last week, and that is, it's really time to press forward. It's time to call things for what they are, and it's time to really prosecute the Republican criminals and their collaborators for what they've done.
Yeah, and see, so like just at the minimum of using the framework already established from Nuremberg, we can already plug in a lot of their audio tapes, their video tapes, all the written directives, the orders to the soldiers, where they were at.
Yes, you know, there's definitely evidence out there.
Just like they did at Nuremberg. Some of those guys, like, their case was made in like 2 days.
Well, thank you very much.
There's so much evidence out there. What would it take to make a case?
That's a good question. Thank you very much for thank you very much for your call.
And how do you go around the rest of the world telling them, like, oh yeah, you got to treat your people right, you know? And like, look at the, you know, as a nurse, I should feel bad that the Iraqi people didn't get their hospitals and stuff, and their, you know, like Parsons ripped them off. But that was hospitals and clinics stolen from us here. That's the resources that were taken here.
And very true. Thanks for your call. The number to call, 503-231-8187, and. We're talking about prosecuting the Republicans. Basically, we're talking about something that is effectively, hate to put it in these terms, but it's effectively political intimidation. The thing is, the Bushites use political intimidation to get their way in a really grotesque manner, and they have not responded to any calls for, as the senator famously said to McCarthy, for, at long last, decency. They don't care about decency, and so in order to reduce their power, we have to turn that tide of intimidation against them, and it should be done properly, however, not by producing lies, but by responsibly producing people for prosecution to, for example, these German courts. And Rumsfeld should be rendered to Germany as soon as possible to be tried, I think, for war crimes. And once the United States starts acting in that manner and starts acting responsibly, in Iraq, for example, pulling out our troops, paying massive war reparations, issuing an apology, that sort of thing, then maybe we can start moving on some very pressing, very important issues like redistribution of wealth in the United States, redistribution of information and power, and the cessation and reversal of global warming. These are things that we need to be working on. And our government is basically in our way. Our government opposes what the people need, and that's because largely because of this Republican fascist juggernaut. Oh, well, heck, I can't blame them for everything, can I? But they're the latest and the worst, aren't they? Number call 503-231-8187. Speaking of intimidation and lies, U.S. President George Bush was informed on Tuesday of an initiative to establish a center under his name in Israel as a sign of gratitude for his support for the country and its security. Outgoing Israel Ambassador to the United States, David Ayalon, asked Bush for the go-ahead to establish such a center during a farewell meeting with the president and his deputy, Dick Cheney. Bush told Ayalon that freedom would be a worthy subject for the center to focus on, and Ayalon said, "Now, Ayalon has yet to approach donors with a request to finance the establishment of the Bush Center in Israel, but does not expect to encounter difficulties when it comes to raising the funds. The outgoing ambassador will continue to work on the matter with the White House Chief of Staff, Joshua Bolton." I believe Riza is on the line. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Hi, Riza.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having the show, and really love the fact that you're exposing some of the Democrats who have been following the Bush administration policy for a long time now.
That sort of conformity is really dangerous right now, and if they have a chance, the Democrats will resume their position as second in line for the gravy train.
Definitely. What I want to tell your listeners is that I don't really distinguish between the Democrats and the Republicans anymore. What I do is follow the money, and for me, following the AIPAC money is really, that's where you find the warmongers. It seems to me that Senator Wyden, Pelosi, Lieberman, Kerry, these are all people who belong to the establishment, and until we can get them out of Congress, I don't think anything is really going to change.
I think you're really onto something there, and I'm alarmed to think that Wyden's to the left of Smith, and then if Israel wants anything, Wyden's right there.
Oh, definitely. Wyden's actually, I think, top three as far as AIPAC money recipients over his career.
I want to clarify.
I think Nancy Pelosi actually might be number one. So,
I want to clarify. If Israel wants anything, I'm not automatically against it. What I mean is, if Israel wants something to exacerbate their military hegemony over the Middle East, which I find obnoxious and utterly destructive and probably extremely, well, it's so dangerous, then Wyden is there for them, and that's a bad thing.
Definitely. I'm not against the state of Israel. My parents are from Iran, and there's actually a fairly large Jewish community that lives in Iran. Their numbers have been dwindling just because of some of the extremist policies of the mullahs in Iran. But they're still protected under law there.
Ahmadinejad actually has made it pretty clear that he's against Zionism, not that he's against Israelis as a race or something like that.
I guess I take it a little bit further. Ahmadinejad is not Iran's president. He's a puppet. The elections there are rigged on a regular basis. I really don't think that he's the president. As long as the Guardian Council decides who gets on the ballot in Iran, you cannot take those elections seriously.
Oh, good point.
That's not who represents Iran's population. In fact, outside of China, Iran might be the most closed society in the whole entire world, as far as like information getting in and out. I just had family members tell me that now there's a widespread campaign by the government in Iran to eradicate satellite dishes. So they're basically going around confiscating people's satellite dishes because they don't want them getting exposed to information from outside the country.
That would be the religious extremists. Well, thank you for your call. I'm getting a little short on time, and I want to give the next two people a chance if I can. And let's see. I think I have Francis.
Hi. I had a question about the Baker-Hamilton Commission.
Uh-huh.
Now, as I understand it, Mr. Baker is a member of the Carlyle Group.
He is.
So although this is viewed as a bipartisan commission, there may be some conflicts of interest.
I think so, yeah. It's funny that it's taken on a different tone now, because originally it was intended as a sop to the Democrats to get them to shut up about the fact that they had no input on the war in Iraq, and now that the elections have gone badly for the Republicans, then all this attention is being given to this supposedly bipartisan commission. However, the commission, if you look at the people who make it up, is not going to produce any radical ideas.
And one thing that
they're not seriously going to challenge the fact that the U.S. has decided to establish permanent bases in Iraq. I mean, that's what Bush is not going to budge on.
Right, and a gentleman who is, I can't remember his name, he's the national security person in Iraq, expressed concern that this commission has not talked to any of them, and they're waiting to see what they come up with. They're not included in the discussion.
It's another way of proscribing the debate. It's like, would you like this right-wing proposal, or would you like this far-right proposal, or never mind, because President George Bush has told senior advisors that the U.S. and its allies must make a last big push to win the war. He's going to ignore the commission. And instead of beginning a troop withdrawal next year, he's going to increase U.S. forces by up to 20,000 soldiers.
Right. Well, I hope that the Democrats heard the American people. And 20% of the Republicans who voted for Democrats did not vote for them to keep the status quo.
I have hope, but my hope is not in the big dogs in the Republican Party. It's in the Congressional Black Caucus, and right now Nancy Pelosi, according to Wayne Madsen, is trying to outmaneuver the Black Caucus to keep them out of the committee chairs, and I think that's disgusting.
Uh-oh.
But thanks for your call.
Thanks.
And time for one more call. Patty, are you there? Let's see if we have Patty. Hello, Patty.
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to share a little information with you, Teresa. The third participant on Democracy Now! Was a from American Enterprise Institute.
Ah, think tank, okay.
And it's an offshoot of AIPAC, actually. And if you heard his discussion, he was very much, pushing for bombing Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
yeah.
It's important to realize that, as the gentleman before said, Democrat, Republicans, it really doesn't make much difference because AIPAC's influence is so prevalent in both parties. And I believe that either party would be pushing for some aggressive behavior towards Iran.
It's up to us, basically. If we want to stop this war against Iran, we're just going to have to get out and stop it.
Right. But connect the dots and realize who's working with whom, and that some of these think tanks are offshoots of AIPAC.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that information.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Excellent point. Time is 9:28, so it's getting time for me to wrap up Press Watch. But before I go, a couple of matters of gender. A Brazilian model has died of anorexia in Sao Paulo. A model, Anna Carolina Rustin, 21 years old, died of anorexia nervosa. She was, 1.72 meters tall. What's that about? That's getting close to 6 feet. And weighed only 40 kilograms, was in the hospital since October 25th due to a kidney malfunction. Her condition became more serious and deteriorated into a generalized infection. There, say that three times quickly. That led to the young woman's death on Tuesday. And she worked for modeling agencies such as Ford, Elite, and L'Equipe in countries like China, Turkey, Mexico, and Japan. And then in Islamabad, after months of debate, the Pakistani government pushed legislation through parliament on Wednesday that would amend the country's rape laws, which have been vilified, according to the German press agency, as unfair to women. And the Hudud laws were enacted in 79. A woman had to produce four witnesses to prove rape. And now they're going to back off on that a little bit, but still, they'll charge you $166 if they catch you having an extramarital affair while being female. So the people in the United States who would force pregnancies aren't the only ones who are down on women. I just wanted to put that in there. So you've been listening to Press Watch. Stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time evening news and public affairs director. We're looking for someone with news and public affairs skills, writing, editing, production, and training experience in working with volunteers. The job requires the ability to work under deadlines, to work under pressure, and to work evening hours. The ability to work with a wide variety of people in a multicultural and cooperative environment is essential. For more information and to get a job application, please contact Chris Merrick, care of News Director Hiring Committee at KBOO, or go online at www.kboo.fm for an online job description. KBOO is an equal employment opportunity employer. Deadline is Friday, November the 17th at 5 p.m.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. Good morning. It's still the Thursday morning Radio Zine. Coming up next, Per Fagerin interviews John Ross, writer and journalist living in Mexico. All that coming up next on the Thursday morning Radio Zine. Stay tuned.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagerin, KBOO News of Public Affairs, and our guest is John Ross, who's been living in Mexico for a long time. He's written books on the Zapatistas and novels and all kinds of stuff, poetry. Who is he's in Eugene right now, and he will be appearing. John, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, it's great to hear Blue Monk there to lead Blue, in. Here.
Well, that's sort of become the theme song, you know?
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Anyway, so tonight you're going to be at Lewis and Clark.
Right, I'll be at Lewis and Clark tonight and tomorrow night, the annual appearance or biannual appearance at Laughing Horse Books, which is always kind of my first stop on the literary scene in Portland, Oregon.
Right, and you know, they have moved. They are now on 10th and Burnside, just about a few doors north of Burnside on 10th Avenue, so it's real close here to KBOO. At Lewis and Clark, are you going to be, you know, is it the Agnes Flanagan Chapel, or where is it?
I think we're in the co-op.
The co-op, okay. That's Lewis and Clark tonight, Laughing Horse tomorrow. Okay, so you've been on this book tour. How's it been going?
Well, it's going. You know, I mean, one moves around, I'm kind of keeping one eye peeled on my hometown and what's going on back in Mexico. Because things are heating up again, as they have been extremely hot for the last bunch of months. And so it's kind of feel kind of the tug to be there as on Monday the legitimate president of the country, the man who had the election stolen from him, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, will be inaugurated in the Zócalo Plaza, the great central plaza in Mexico City, with perhaps a million people there.
Uh-huh.
And that will be a preparation for the official inauguration of the person that was
the
awarded
usurper.
The election, Felipe Calderón, from
uh-huh.
the right-wing Pound Party on December 1st. The military police have already encircled the legislative palace where the swearing-in will take place on December 1st and are constructing 2 meter tall metal barricades to keep the populace at bay.
I see. Now the palace is right down at the Zócalo also, isn't it?
Excuse me?
Is it the palace is down there, the Zócalo also?
Yeah, it's about 5 blocks away, actually.
Oh, okay.
Probably 10 blocks away, actually.
Oh, I thought it was right there in that huge, vast square or something. That's The National Palace, where they have those Rivera murals?
And that's the National Palace.
Oh, okay.
The Legislative Palace, where the Congress meets, is about 10 blocks east.
I see. Okay. Well, gee whiz. So, well, you know, there's lots of things going on. The Zapatistas are sort of going on this tour of Mexico. And there's also the goings-on in Oaxaca, and plus, you know, the...
Yeah, Oaxaca has been, of course, a particularly torrid flashpoint for months.
Mm-hmm.
And this began way back in May with a teacher strike that has become kind of traditional each May, which is when teachers negotiate their new contracts. But due to the administrations of the governor of Oaxaca, Ulises Ruiz, a member of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the party that ran Mexico for seven decades. He unleashed the police on the teachers in the middle of June, and as a result of that, the teachers actually fought off the police and took back the central plaza where they've been encamped for the past 5 months. But as a result of the repression, a statewide assembly was formed, the APU, the Popular Assembly, which involves representatives from over 400 majority indigenous municipalities or counties in the state of Oaxaca, and they have joined the teachers in the Central Plaza and have been there for the last 4 or 5 months. A couple of weeks ago, after indie media reporter, perhaps the first indie media martyr, Brad Will, was gunned down by those folks associated with the governor. We like to, or don't really like to, but can only characterize them as death squads sent by the governor.
Mm-hmm.
The federal preventive police were sent into the city and took back the central plaza, but the people that were behind the barricades in the center of the city fanned out and took the local university, the Benito Juarez Autonomous University, and also encamped at the Santo Domingo Cathedral on the other side of the Zocalo. So they essentially have the federal preventive police surrounded.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, the governor was scheduled to deliver his State of the State message to the Oaxaca Congress, but did not go, fearing that the demonstrations would keep him away. Indeed, they did. There were about 10,000 people marching through the streets in support of the APU and the teachers. And so the State of the State address was delivered by the Secretary of Government and not read at all. So, in effect, the protesters prevented the governor from making his State of the State message. Their demand, of course, is the removal of the governor, and that's what's at the heart of this battle.
Is there any chance he may be removed? I hear that, you know, the Senate, the National Senate, voted to ask him to resign, didn't they?
Well, there's been, you know, they voted twice. They mm-hmm. voted one time, the first round, maybe about 3 weeks ago, upholding Ruiz's regime, essentially the characteristic is called disappearance of powers. They voted against the disappearance of power in Oaxaca, but then the following week they voted they asked the governor to remove himself. So it was not a binding resolution at all of Congress, and left it up to the conscience of the governor of Ruiz to resign. But as all of us who have been in this thing for a while understand, Ulises Ruiz really doesn't have a conscience.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't about to take that advice. This thing has been hanging fire, as I said, for 5 months, and each day seems to bring us a new development and a new flashpoint in the city. The death of Bradley Will, I think, has galvanized a lot of support for the movement in Oaxaca all over the world. There have been demonstrations outside Mexican consulates and embassies all over Europe and in Canada, as well as all over the United States, and has also generated a parallel movement in Mexico City. And so you have this kind of coalescence of these movements from down below, the movement that has been fighting to straighten out the stolen election in July and the movement in Oaxaca coming together around these issues of who's going to be in charge here. And really, you know, we get it explained to us a lot as being, oh, the right wing and the left wing and the center, but it's really not that. It is this upsurge from down below.
Mm-hmm.
All the people on the barricades in Oaxaca, all the people that were in the 7 weeks of sit-ins and what we call plantones in Mexico City are from the underclass in the country, the brown people from the underclass.
Right.
The tiny white elite that controls the political class is, you know, really the color of money. So there's a lot of race and class roots to struggle that has now been going on for 6 months.
I understand that supporters are marching to Oaxaca from all over Mexico, and there's something, a similar group apparently is coming in from the neighboring state of Guerrero, which has always been a sort of a hot spot anyway.
Yeah, the there have been a number of caravans that have arrived in Oaxaca and are arriving almost every day from Guerrero and Michoacán. These are dissident teachers supporting Section 22 of the Teachers Union. A caravan of the civil society from Mexico City left on Sunday, and they should be in Oaxaca today mm-hmm. or have been there, I guess, for a couple of days. One of the caravans that really struck me was a group from Oaxaca, from Chiapas, which neighbors Oaxaca, Las Abejas, the bees. These were the folks whose people were slaughtered back in 1997 by paramilitary.
That Octayal massacre, yes, uh-huh.
And they have arrived with truckloads of food and corn to feed the people who are on strike, the teachers and the APU in Oaxaca. So I think that was really a very moving message of solidarity mm-hmm. from people that have very little to give.
I understand that the teachers voted to go back to the schools, or what? What's happening
well,
there?
Well, there was a vote taken. It was a very narrow vote.
Mm-hmm.
The vote was to go back to work, and that was 2 weeks ago. It was 30,000 teachers voted in favor and 21,000 against. But the return to class has been very slow. It hasn't really taken place yet.
Mm.
And yesterday, for example, the day before, the rector of the university had said the university would be functioning smoothly this week, but the university has not been able to function. And yesterday, on the march, 10,000 teachers absented themselves from going back to the classroom and chose to protest the governor's attempt to deliver a State of the State message. So it's the return of teachers to the classroom, which potentially is very divisive for the movement in the streets, has not really been affected, at least in any kind of sense of totality in the state. It's been spotty in some places. The teachers have gone back to work, in other places they are not.
Let's talk about the Zapatistas. Now, they are going on this sort of a, I don't know, a traveling through the nation.
I think we could call it an odyssey.
An odyssey, okay. But anyway, I heard, well, they went up Baja, you know, up to Tijuana, and I heard that they sort of met with indigenous people from North America. They sort of talked through the fence or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And is that what happened?
Well, you know, this has all been, I think the word really is odyssey, because it takes you to many places, and,
mm-hmm.
and the root of this odyssey is not exactly fixed. So they have been wandering in the northern desert here for a while. This is all part of a campaign which the Zapatistas called the Other Campaign, which was launched January 1st. It was really, it's part of a time that in my new book, Zapatistas Making Another World Possible, I describe as the time to move on, when the Comandancia of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation decided, and I think rightly so, that the communities themselves, civil Zapatismo as we call it, were perfectly capable of running their own affairs and no longer needed the intervention of the comandantes and of the political military structure of the EZLN to help them to administer and construct this autonomy which is being built in Chiapas, making another world possible. And so they were looking for other work, other chamba, as we say in Mexico. That other work is to travel around the country and to listen to the people down at the bottom and learn of their struggles and resistance in place where they are. Mm-hmm. And so the ELN, under the guise of Subcomandante Marcos, now doing business as Delegate Zero, set out on this journey that it took them all through southern Mexico. And I'll be reading some sections of the new book that kind of described those journeys at Laughing Horse on Friday night. But when they got to Mexico City, there was this terrible confrontation in San Salvador Atenco, right outside the city, where militant farmers were confronted by the federal, militarized federal police. And 200 people were arrested, 2 young men were killed, 23 women were sexually abused by the police during being transported to jail. It was just a gross violation of human rights. And the Zapatistas suspended the other campaign until the prisoners from Atenco were released. And at the same time, the election kicked into high gear. The elections are not Zapatista time. They dislike elections. They think the political parties are corrupt. They encourage people not to vote. And here we were at July 2nd with this very important election, perhaps the most important election in Mexican history, in front of us. And the Zapatistas were kind of attacking the left, and their candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And then the electoral fraud kicked in, and this generated a movement of millions of people and really kind of relegated the other campaign to the sidelines, to the back burner, and marginated it greatly. And it's only been in October that they've resumed their itinerary moving through the north of Mexico. They were in Tijuana, as you said, meeting with, actually, with U.S. Chicanos, other representatives of the Mexican community, and U.S. anarchists as well. There's been this pronounced alliance between anarchists in the U.S. and I think all over the world, and the Zapatista movement, which is quite interesting. I've been observing a lot of that on this tour. And now the Zapatistas are moving along the border and in the north. I think yesterday they were in San Luis Potosí. This is, you know, all a desert region, so I think we have some justification to describe them as wandering in the desert. And they will continue on out to Ciudad. They've been in Ciudad Juarez. They'll continue moving along the border all the way out to the Gulf in the next couple of months and return to Chiapas by Christmas time.
And I understand that they have planned something for next year, some kind of a meeting with indigenous peoples from all the Americas. Is that true?
Yeah, it will be in Mexicali, if I believe, on the border.
Mm-hmm.
Delegate Zero met with, there are a number of very small indigenous cultures in the Baja California and Sonora Desert. And he met with many of them. Many of these are groups that used to be able to cross the border. They have the right to cross the border because they have populations on both sides, and they've been prohibited. And so by calling together North American indigenous people and people from the South as well, it really is an attempt to focus attentions on the plight of the Kukapa people and the Kumai people and the Pai Pai people and the Kikapu people, all of whom have been able to cross the border until now, and now are confronted with this triple barrier that the Republicans and the Democrats in Congress both endorsed.
Yeah, meanwhile, I also read that Bolivia's President Evo Morales met with some North American indigenous people, including Alex Whiteplume, who is the tribal chairman at the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, who was recently reelected.
Well, I think there's been, you know, a great deal of cross-border, globalization from down below.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, interchanges between indigenous people all over the continent. I was in Bolivia and Peru and Ecuador, majority indigenous countries, just a couple of years ago, and kind of surveying the impacts of the Zapatista movement upon this heart of Latin America. We're talking 40 million indigenous people living in these three countries, and we throw in Paraguay, we have a fourth majority indigenous country. And, there are everyone knows about the Zapatista movement, but at the same time, they've been moving in a parallel fashion, often utilizing the same techniques and the same legal precedents the Zapatistas have been using. So there's a lot of interchange between strategies and tactics of indigenous people, both in the heart of Latin America and other places around the continent, specifically in Mexico, which has 15 million indigenous people, probably the second largest of the indigenous populations in Latin America.
Well, and what is, so now AMLO is going to be inaugurated when?
That will be on Monday.
Monday, okay.
November 20th. We can expect that from the 20th, actually it's all begun. There were demonstrations 2 days ago that took over Walmart in Mexico City. There will be demonstrations and marches right on now through the December 1st when the attempt will be to inaugurate Felipe Calderón. And the meeting on the 20th will confirm the legitimacy of Andrés Manuel López Obrador's designation as the legitimate president of the country, and he's appointed his own cabinet, the establishment of a parallel government. Mm-hmm. And for the 10 days between November 20th and December 1st, I think we can expect to see daily marches and perhaps again a retaking of the streets of Mexico City as occurred for 7 weeks this past summer, which I had the great privilege to participate in.
Oh, they had the whole reform
day in and day out.
So what is López Obrador's, does he have a plan for the next 6 years, or what's...
I think the main aspect of this plan is, well, you know, there are actually two ways to go. One is to present an alternative to neoliberalism, and what that means in terms of very concrete struggles and programs. And the other is to make it difficult for Felipe Calderón to run the country for the next 6 years. And I think that is a given. He will have to move in a bubble, a security bubble around the country. It will be difficult for him to actually be in public. We have one precedent back in 1988. Carlos Salinas stole the election from Cuauhtemoc Cardenas, and he ruled with the military in the street for 2 years. I think we can expect to see much of the same with Felipe Calderón over the next little while here.
Well, you know, seems to be like there's a convergence happening here. You have the Zapatistas and the PRD party of López Obrador and the Indians. I mean, it's just, are they kind of joining together?
That's what I will be talking about tonight, Lewis and Clark, 7 o'clock in the co-op, basically about what we call the coyuntura, the coming together of all of these factors, the subjective factor being the movement of the people in Oaxaca and Mexico City, the other campaign moving through the north, and the other, the objective conditions which have brought us to this point. And, you know, this is the way revolution takes place in Mexico. It takes place in many parts. It's always a coming together of regional struggles, and the struggles that may be entirely different, struggles that deal with the rectifying of a stolen election, struggles that deal with the removal of a repressive governor, struggles that deal with the plight of the poorest of the poor in Mexico. These are three perhaps separate issues, but they all really come together and braid together in this kind of national panorama of struggle from down below. And I think that's what we're seeing in Mexico. And whenever we get in these kind of moments of coyuntura, of coming together, it always feels like history is happening. And I think that's what I'm feeling, is that history is happening in my country, and I'm kind of traveling around telling people around it. But, you know, I'd much rather be back there on the streets and you know, being part of history rather than having to report on it.
Make you think of, Zapata and Pancho Villa, the armies of the North and South meeting in Mexico City in the original revolution. Yeah.
Precisely.
Well, I don't know, also makes you think of the Paris Commune in some ways.
Well, I think there's been a lot of parallels in Oaxaca because, you know, it does take place behind the barricades. And so, you know, the construction of the barricades kind of puts you in that Paris Commune mode, and some people have been calling the struggle in Oaxaca City the Comuna de Oaxaca, the Oaxaca Commune. So it does, you know, it's got those kind of vestiges of history of struggle of left that date back centuries now, you know. one of the things about the left is that we sometimes just think in the present, you know, but we have a long and very rich history, international history, not just a national history. And these parallels, I think, infuse us with the spirit and understanding that, you know, things can be changed. And I think that's what Mexico is teaching us. Mm-hmm. Certainly the rejection of the stealing of the election contrasted very sharply with the way U.S. citizens accepted the 2000 election and the 2004 stealing of mm-hmm. both of those elections, and indeed accepted this last round of midterm elections, in which now the Democrats seem to consider to have a mandate to do nothing about a war that's taken the lives of 650,000 Iraqis. And, mm-hmm. you know, if we take a look at their first actions after winning this election, we see them doing precisely what the Bush administration has done. And what's missing here is, of course, the action in the street, that pressure from down below, the subjective factor that we've seen at play in Mexico so fiercely in the last 6 months.
Well, you know, if the ruling elites can't govern, then that leaves it up to the people. They'll have to govern themselves, which
I think that's precisely the point. And, you know, mm-hmm. this is a message that now has to leap over a triple barrier if they ever get around to building this incredible wall that they're talking about. I'm sure they're going to bring in Israeli engineers, because the Israelis are such experts at building their walls.
But, where would it go, across the middle of Mexico, dividing north and south, or what?
Well, yeah, I know, this concept of trying to keep people out by building a wall is, there's something wrong with this concept.
Oh, yeah.
People are coming because of great necessity, and that great mm-hmm. necessity is really in large part due to neoliberalism and that beacon of globalization that we call the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has put 6 million farming people off the land
right.
in the 12 years it existed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can expect that this will be the chickens coming home to roost.
Well, you know, the next national election in Mexico is in 2012, which is the sort of this prophesied, I don't know, the Mayans have this idea of something big happening then.
Well, yeah, it is the end of of this cycle and the beginning uh-huh. of another one on the Mayan calendar. But let's also remember the political calendar in Mexico in 1810. The struggle began to liberate the country from the crown, from Spain. In 1910, the Mexican Revolution kicked in, changed the nature of class relations in the country. So we will soon be at 2010, and we can watch that calendar as well. These are a couple of really, I think, strong currents coming together, the Mayan calendar, the cycle ending, and also this political calendar, where every 100 years Mexico seems to be in a state of revolution.
Well, how is your calendar? Now, when are you due back in Mexico City?
I'll be back in the first week in December, one final date at my favorite university in this country, Evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
Go up and talk to the folks at Rachel Corey U. And then I'll be back on the streets of Mexico City for a couple of months, and not only Mexico City, but in Oaxaca and Chiapas. There will be on the first of the year a Intergalactica, a meeting of international supporters of the EZLN in Oventic, one of the Caracoles, or public centers of the Zapatistas, just above San Cristobal. So we expect to see a lot of comrades there as well.
There was some big project on the works, you know, this kind of dry land canal across the isthmus of Mexico, kind of from the Gulf to the Pacific. Is that still on the works, or is that just kind of...
Well, you know, this is called the Plan Pueblo Panama.
Right.
And in a real sense, it was like Vicente Fox's development plan. Each president has his own development agenda. And generally, it's just on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what happened with the Plan Pueblo Panama. It was never really put into practice.
Uh-huh.
Although there were some roads built and some forests cut down. And that's always the sad part of these so-called development agendas that never happen is that a lot of white elephants get built, mm-hmm. and a lot of destruction gets done while these projects are never completed. And so there is no dry canal, mm-hmm. and very little of the Plan Pueblo Panama was ever put into effect.
Well, I guess we're at the end of our time. We've been talking with John Ross, author and raconteur and Human Shield.
I'm a storyteller, so, you know, come out and hear some stories on Friday night at Laughing Horse Books.
And he will be at Lewis and Clark tonight. Now you're getting up from Eugene, okay, on
the
train?
We'll be up there this afternoon.
And then tomorrow night at Laughing Horse Books. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'll be seeing you probably at Laughing Horse tomorrow night. So thanks a lot for being with us.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for calling.
Okay, well, that's it for this segment of Fight the Empire. We've been talking with John Ross, and he's I hope a lot of people will show up at his talk tonight or tomorrow. He's really a very engaging fellow, and he's written some really wonderful books about the Zapatistas. So that's all for today. Thank you very much for listening.
It's 10 o'clock. This is a Thursday morning radio zine for Thursday, November 16th. You're listening to listener-sponsored KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's DIY Portland with host Julie Sabatier. This month, the show goes technical and explores the world of open-source software with guests from Free Geek and other local organizations working to provide alternatives to the world of Microsoft. Stay tuned for that.